It's great to be here today. Thank you all for taking the time to come out on what was, quite frankly, one of the most beautiful afternoons I think I've ever experienced in my life. What was that? I should live here. I was going to say, if it weren't for those two sets of twins, I'd be moving out here tomorrow. It's going to make it very hard to get on the plane and go home, but it is wonderful, especially to be here on the campus, because as I'll talk about, these partnerships require every sector of the community to come together to think about the success of a child from cradle to career. But quite frankly, one of the sectors that have had the hardest time engaging in this work are higher ed institutions. As we think about education nationally, we often think about K-12. Most folks, when we say education, get that mental model of a little red schoolhouse. I think people are starting to think more about early childhood as the data came out, interestingly enough, right when my second set of twins were born, that said 90% of brain development happens by age 3. That terrified me, as you can well imagine. But over time, higher ed institutions, I think, are starting to realize that they also play this critical, critical role, not just in the education of a child, but in helping a community achieve economic development goals. And so when we talk about supporting the success of every child cradle to career, it is fundamentally critical that the higher ed institutions are not only connected to K-12, but are also connected to the businesses in the community so that we can make sure that we're not just preparing students, but we're preparing them for high-demand careers right here in your own backyard. So the fact that the president and the university as a whole have stepped out to say, we're going to invest in somebody to begin to facilitate what I want to say to you all is going to be a long journey of figuring out how across this county you can support the success of every child cradle to career. The fact that they have stepped out to figure out not just how they can begin to facilitate it, but they can also look internally within the institution to think about how they can do things differently. I had the pleasure of meeting with faculty and other administrators in the university earlier today. They're really looking internally to say, what can we actually do differently? And quite frankly, it's going to require everybody in the community, everybody in this room, and all the institutions that contribute to a child's learning along that cradle-to-career continuum, not just in the formal early childhood systems, the formal K-12 systems, the formal higher ed systems. It's going to take everybody, investors, businesses, nonprofits, civic leaders, everybody thinking about what do I need to do a little bit differently than what I'm doing today in order to achieve that outcome. Unfortunately, across the country, what we have most of the time is not folks thinking about how they can work together, but pointing fingers at each other. So in Albuquerque, they have a cradle-to-career partnership called Mission Graduate. And one of their key partners is actually the newspaper. And one of the key players got together right at the start with the newspaper and said, could you capture for us in one slide the problem we're trying to address? And what I thought was interesting is rather than throwing the statistics, which is usually, I think, what people expect when they come to get an education presentation, this is what they showed. They didn't blame it on the kids. They didn't end up throwing all those stats up there that we know we have to change. What they did was really look at the adults. And I think what far too often we have is the businesses pointing fingers at higher ed pointing fingers at K-12, K-12 pointing fingers at early childhood, everybody else pointing fingers at each other. And what we end up with is a complete lack of accountability overall for the success of children. We point to one institution, specifically superintendents for the most part, and we say it is your job to educate a child. But the goal of this work, this whole idea of collective impact, and what I'm going to do is walk you through what happened in Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky and paint what I hope you'll find to be a very honest story about what happened there. I want to talk to you about some of the lessons we've now learned from this broader network of over 100 communities that are just like you, trying to figure out how to build this, and then try to give you a little snapshot of what it could look like on the ground and even give you a couple communities that you may look to as benchmarks. But what we see far too often all across the country is this picture where we have all these different players looking to point and place blame on different partners rather than taking ownership themselves. And our hope is going to be is that over time, as we begin to realize that complex social challenges require all these different players to work together, is that we can actually have a cartoon where everybody's joining arm in arm. And the question isn't about whether or not kids are succeeding. The question is about what more could we be doing to build on our successes? That, in the end, is what this Cradle to Career partnership work is going to be all about. So let me start with just a little bit of story from Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky. This work started way back, honestly, in 2004, where it happened to be the president of the university there who came to town, and she had worked for years, her name's Nancy Zimfer, she had worked for years to try to think about the ways that higher ed could better interface with K-12. But what she started to realize is just bridging that gap between higher ed and K-12 was not going to be enough. She started to realize that in addition to the connections that need to be made between these often siloed educational systems, we had to have philanthropy at the table, we had to have nonprofits at the table, we had to have the faith community at the table, we had to have other civic officials at the table. We needed to create a cradle-to-career partnership. So slowly but surely, some energy started to grow. How many of you remember the book The World is Flat? Anybody remember that book? All right, it was the first major book, maybe not the first, I don't really know that, to be honest with you, but it talked about globalization. It talked about the fact that we were no longer competing in Ohio with Indiana. We were competing with India, right? We began to realize that the world of the knowledge economy was going to mean that we were competing with people all over the globe. And the question became, if we wanted to stay competitive in Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky, for those of you who don't know, Cincinnati is a two-state city, right? On one side of the Ohio River is Ohio, and on the other side is Kentucky, and the urban core is really in two states. If we as a region wanted to stay competitive, we had to start thinking about not just getting kids into college, which had been the primary focus of education initiatives, but we had to focus on how we were going to get kids in and through college. And not only that, we were going to have to think about how to get them in and through college and into meaningful careers that would actually earn a living wage and enable students to be successful over the long term. So there was this momentum around how are we actually going to get kids in and through college. And then there was also the funders in our community, the investors in our community, as we prefer to call them. They were standing up and saying, how can we get more bang for our buck? We started to feel like they started to feel like that they were putting a lot of money in education, but they weren't getting a lot of return. As one of the funders said, I feel like we have a spray and pray mentality to education where we're spraying resources all over the place and we're praying good things happen. At some point, we had to realize that we were program rich and system poor. And we had to figure out how to become system rich. So this was fermenting. But what really got Cincinnati moving was when we had a group of leaders, over 150 community leaders in a room, and the coroner of our community stood up. And by the way, the coroner is now the president of the community college. Is that not interesting? Right? He was also one of the doctors who was involved in the very first test tube baby. So this guy has really seen the entire cradle-to-career continuum, really cradle-to-grave continuum in his entire life. But he stood up during the meeting and he said, listen, folks, I need to put this in as blunt a terms as I can. We are going to keep being program rich and system poor unless we begin to think at a higher level. And he said, if we don't become system rich, not only are we not going to get more kids in and through college, I'm going to keep seeing dead kids on my table. Essentially, what he did was make this a matter of life and death. And I would venture to say that when we begin to think about the health of our communities over the long term, when we begin to think about a global society, when we begin to think about getting a true social return on investment, it really is that for many children. The success of children hinges upon all these players, and you have the logos in Monterey County, just like we have the logos in Cincinnati. It's going to depend on all of these players beginning to think much more systemically. So in one of the earlier meetings today, somebody said, what could possibly get us there? What would be the first step? And let me tell you that in our community, we were drowning for a while. We were making no progress whatsoever. We were asset mapping things all over the place. We were trying to talk about what we could do new and different, even though we knew there weren't necessarily going to be a lot of new resources on the table. What turned the tide for us was when one of our leaders said, let's stop talking for 1 second about what it is that we need to do, let's talk about what we want to accomplish. And the first thing we did was create a visual, a new mental model for what education could be beyond the little red schoolhouse. And essentially what this said for our community was that learning actually starts at birth and it goes through some form of college and career. It isn't just about the ages of 5 to 18. We know that learning starts at birth. We know that now, as one student in our community said, if you don't go to some form of college, you very well may end up flipping burgers. We know that the entire continuum matters. And not only that, we know there's academic benchmarks, but we also know that there's student and family support benchmarks, social emotional benchmarks that we need to make sure we're paying attention to along that entire continuum. The benefit of creating this visual was that all the different partners in the community could begin to see themselves in this. They could begin to understand that actually we can't keep pointing at people. We have to start taking responsibility because my piece of the puzzle may be down here or my piece of the puzzle may be up here. So we created a new mental model for folks that began to enable them to see themselves in the solution. But the most important thing we did, without a doubt, was establish a true north. How many of you have seen the movie Lincoln? All right, pretty good number of folks. I'm going to tell you a story from this movie, and I'm not ruining it for you because all of you know how it ends. It was tragic, all right? But there was an incredibly poignant moment in that movie where they're just about to get the 13th Amendment passed, and this was a risky proposition. There were a lot of folks that were working counter to this. And the president was sitting down and he was speaking with one of his key allies who was actually almost working against this because he wanted the bill to be perfect. And he sat down with him and he said, listen, I learned the value of a compass when I was a surveyor. When I was young, I was a surveyor and I learned the value of a compass. And what I learned was is that compass would always show me the true north. It would always show us where we needed to go. We were never lost. What I also learned was the value of charting the right path so we didn't drown in the swamp or die in the desert. But what we need to keep in mind is the true north of where we want to go, and then we have to chart a reasonable path to get there. Far too often in education reform, we want to talk about, as I said before, what we want to do. We don't want to establish for ourselves where we're trying to go. So even with this vision for a while and our efforts to asset map all these different activities in our community, we still honestly didn't know where it was we wanted to go. The critical moment was when somebody said, let's set some concrete targets around what we believe are the community vital signs for education. Let's set some very concrete targets for what we believe to be the community vital signs for education. Let's hold ourselves as accountable as a doctor would for the success of their patient, as we would for the educational outcomes of children. And after a host of efforts that we can talk about later, we finally landed on a core set of outcomes. We took into account what data we actually had, what was affordable to collect, what actually had communication power, and we realized that there were 8 vital signs that we needed to be tracking on an ongoing basis. And quite frankly, if we all were not willing to publish on an annual basis where things stood. And not only that, if we weren't all willing to stand up and report on our progress collectively, we weren't going to succeed. So very quickly, we began to start working on not just identifying what the outcomes were, but what were the targets and what were the trend lines that we wanted to see over the long term. This became our true north. So as we were trying to figure out what it meant to build a cradle-to-career learning system, rather than me having to use 3,000 words to explain how challenging systems change is, I could very simply say we are a cross-sector group of partners from the education, business, nonprofit, philanthropic, civic communities that are going to move these dials. That is what we are all about as a community. And when we report on the data, rather than having the superintendent stand up alone and report on the high school graduation rate, we're going to have a business leader stand up and report on the graduation rate and declare that he or she owns that outcome just as much as the superintendent. That's the kind of ownership that has to be established around the true north that we see as being so critical. Does that make sense? So the challenge at that point was, how could we move those dials if we knew there wasn't going to be a lot more money? Quite frankly, right when we launched the partnership is when the market started to crash. And we stumbled upon this concept of continuous improvement. There's another great book out there called Switch. If you haven't read it, I'd strongly recommend it. It's about how to get people to change when change is hard. And the core insight in that book is that you have to start building on your bright spots. And what we started to realize was that rather than look to New York or LA or anywhere else for those practices that we thought could move the dial, why didn't we start looking in our own backyard? Why didn't we start looking against those 8 outcomes, what was actually moving the dial already? So very concretely, an example like this, we pulled together all the practitioners that were working around college enrollment. They provided their programmatic data. Most of them were not actually collecting very good programmatic data. So our first task was to figure out how we could help them do that. But for those that were collecting good programmatic data, when we actually broke it down and held for all the variables that we possibly could, recognizing that we could not let perfect be the enemy of good, there was a lot of pushback in our community about using data to drive decisions. And the dean of our College of Education actually stood up at one point and he said, "Folks, let me tell you something. People say you can lie with data. You can lie a whole heck of a lot easier without it." His point was, I would much rather us get about 75% of an understanding of the challenge and how we might solve it and use that data to inform our decision than to use none at all. So we started to break down the data as best as we could, and we looked at the programmatic data. It was surprising to us that it wasn't actually doing college visits. It wasn't actually filling out scholarships forms. It wasn't actually visiting college campuses. What was moving the dial was whether or not kids completed the financial aid form. That was the practice that made the difference. How many of you have seen the financial aid form? It's one of the scariest things you'll ever see. You could literally... Well, we're not going to go into that. But the key became, how could our existing programs not reinvent the wheel, not do everything drastically different? How could they incorporate financial aid advising into what they're already doing? So if they're doing group advising, if they're doing one-on-one advising, if they're doing college visits, how can we make sure that no matter what they're doing with children to promote college access, they begin to incorporate financial aid? Financial aid advising. And what we saw was that in certain schools, there were absolutely no programs at all working on college access. In one school, there was 7. Some of the programs moved. They moved. They began to focus on financial aid. In one of our lowest, the schools that had the lowest college enrollment rates, it began to skyrocket. The point is that we didn't have to reinvent the wheel. We didn't have to start new programs. We could actually begin to build on what works, find those bright spots, and accelerate our progress by looking in our own backyard. We did not have to reinvent the wheel. And what I believe for Monterey Bay is that across this entire continuum, cradle to career, you already have tons of bright spots in place. You may be making assumptions about some of those bright spots right now, and the key will be, can you begin to set that true north? And then can you begin to look at the data on the ground about what programmatic activities are actually leading to the outcomes? Not the ones that you believe are, because boy, is it tempting. It's tempting to believe that things are working even when they're not. But can you be disciplined enough here to look in your own backyard and identify those things that are working? I heard there's an incredible early childhood group that's already meeting right now here that is looking at data around what's working for kids. I would bet that the key inflection point, the moment that you're going to move past collaboration to collective impact, and I'll talk about that in a second, will be the moment that you begin to look at the programmatic data to understand what are those practices that really move the dial and begin to focus on spreading those practices as expeditiously as possible. Does that make sense? Does it? Can I get an amen? All right. So the good news is in Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky, right, just one place, we're beginning over time to see more and more student outcomes trend in the right direction. We're working in 3 different urban communities, measuring those 8 outcomes across multiple parochial systems, public school systems, different types of higher ed systems. And every year we're seeing more and more of these outcomes trend in the right direction. And we're not doing it, most importantly, by starting new initiatives and programs. We're doing it by building what already works in our own backyard. And I want to be really clear about something. We are not promoting a model at Strive Together. There is no one way to do this. So when we see these improvements, I am in by no way, shape, or form saying do exactly what we did. But what I am saying is we have learned a host of lessons from sites all across the country at this point who are beginning to take this on so that we can hopefully make your path a little bit smoother as you begin to try to take on this cradle to career continuum. So the question is, what makes this collective impact work unique? How many of you have actually read the collective impact article? Okay, for the professors in the room, I hope you saw that and you give all those people extra credit. But for those of you who didn't read it, I'm going to give you a one-slide explanation of what this concept is really all about. If we start at the bottom here and we say this is what isolated impact is, where we may have multiple sectors operating in isolation, or we may have multiple programs and service providers operating in isolation. What we started to work towards over time was coordinated impact or cumulative impact, whatever you want to call it, which was embodied in the concept of collaboration. And this is when we said, you know, we think we're all working on similar stuff. Let's get together and talk to each other. But honestly, let's just keep doing what we're all doing individually. The step in collective impact that's a little bit different and that builds on this history of collaboration is let's actually work from the same game plan. Let's get all these different sectors working together. Let's get all these different sectors aligned behind that true north. And when we look at the individual outcomes, let's begin to organize the practitioners, the investors, the community advocates who care about that outcome so that we are consistently working from the same game plan. That's the heart of collective impact. Easy, right? Not so much. The downside of this collective impact article is it made it sound super, super easy. It made it sound like anybody can do it. And in a few minutes, I'm going to talk to you about some of our lessons. But the key differentiators between collaboration and collective impact are few. The biggest one, right up front, is that collaboration is often people coming together around a grant application, around the implementation of a program, or around an initiative. The heart of collective impact is bringing together a core group of people, often early adopters, it's not going to be everybody, who are willing to come together to say there's an outcome or more that we want to move, and we collectively are going to come to the table to move that regardless of whether there's more money at the table. And that's critical. Because when people are coming to the table around money, they're typically coming to the table around getting money to do what they're already doing more. When you're coming together around moving an outcome, you're beginning to think about, what do I have to do differently every single day in order to move that dial? The next big piece is fundamentally critical, because in the social sector, particularly the education sector, we have an absolute fear of data. In Cincinnati, we actually adopted a mantra that we said at almost every meeting, love the data. It is not scary, but far too often data has just been used to prove what we're doing is right, not improve what we're doing is really making a difference and can be built on over time. A close friend now, Amy Gadara, who runs the Data Quality Campaign, uses this visual in almost all of her presentations. She says, bottom line is, as long as we keep viewing data as a hammer, we're going to be in trouble. We're going to continue down the road of collaboration. We need to start seeing data as a flashlight that can uncover the positive deviance out there, that can uncover the things at the fringe that may not be getting attention that we need to bring to the center in order to rebuild our education infrastructure. The next big difference between collaboration and collective impact is that it shouldn't be in addition to what you do. Collective impact should be what you do every single day. In most communities that get started on this, there are some initial meetings that need to be held. You do need to pull people together to get an agreement around outcomes. You do need to pull people together to begin to build that data management infrastructure. You do need to bring practitioners together around those outcomes. But as time moves on, the reason that people should come together is because they're actually going to get data to do what they're already doing better. I'm going to take a risk here, and I'm going to tell you all a story that may actually turn some of you off, but I'm just going to go for it anyway. In every community we're working, there's a different player, there's a different person that stands up and says, I need to bring folks together, just like the president has done today. In one community, believe it or not, is a hedge fund manager. It is a hedge fund manager. And I am clueless when it comes to the markets. I mean, I'm talking, my wife is incredible with the checkbook, I think, I hope. But it seems like she's doing a great job. I am a mess. But I went into this meeting at a hedge fund and I thought I had walked into a matrix. Has anybody here ever been to a hedge fund manager's office? Okay. In this room, there were television screens everywhere. And there were just numbers flying around. And I have no idea what's going on here. But we went into this conference room and we're sitting over here and he's got all these community leaders. And throughout the meeting, there's somebody that walks in and starts slipping him pieces of paper. And he actually worked with his wife, so he'd slip her pieces of paper. And then they'd quickly get on their little handheld, they'd do something like this, and they'd put it down. And at one point, I was like, what is going on? What is happening? Because it's so distracting, but I'm very curious. What is going on? And he said, oh, somebody's just handing me a piece of paper with a recommendation with some data behind it, and I'm making a decision about where to move my money. And as crude as that may feel, in communities over time, if we are truly going to treat every minute of time, talent, and treasure that we spend on children as an investment, we need to be crunching data with that level of discipline. We need to try as best we can to understand right now, not 5 years from now, right now, what is working for kids, and quietly be slipping data to the people that are working with kids every day so they can just inform what they're doing and do it a little better. Does that make sense? How many people did I turn off with that example? All right, you're all still with me, I'm hoping. It seems okay. I am certainly not saying, another great book that I'd recommend you read is Good to Great for the Social Sector by Jim Collins. He wrote a book called Good to Great that was business focused. He then wrote Good to Great for the Social Sector and he said, listen, you know what I said about making an organization great for a business? All that stuff applies to the social sector too. It's just a heck of a lot harder because we don't have line control of all the resources. It's harder to get everybody to agree on the outcomes. You have to influence people, not tell them what to do. It's harder in the social sector. So that example I give is not to say that it's going to be easy, but it is to say that if we want to get truly disciplined, we have to be able to slip the data to the people that are working with kids every day, all along that cradle to career continuum, so they have more information to do what they're doing already that much better. The last piece is that we can stop advocating for ideas and we can start advocating for what works. And this is possibly the most exciting thing of all. Imagine if somebody walked up to you and said, gosh, you know, I'm really concerned about our high school graduation rates. And rather than saying, you know, I was listening to NPR, I was listening to the news, and I heard about this thing over here, you could say, do you know what the good news is? We've got a partnership. We've got a partnership that's put its finger on what's working to improve high school graduation rates right here in our own backyard, and this is what we are doing about it. Wouldn't that be empowering? Think about how powerful that would be if uniformly across the community you could do that. And I would challenge you in Cincinnati to do a search of the headlines in our local newspaper. We used to have a headline a day about how terrible education was. As this work has rolled out, we have begun to develop a sense of purpose across the community. So the articles may lift up outcomes that we don't want to see where they are, but they also identify the solutions that we collectively as a community are beginning to identify because we're building on what's working in our own backyard. So to me, what we're trying to do is move from this concept of collaboration to a new philosophy of collective impact. So the question is, what does this actually then look like on the ground? What does it actually look like to make this work go each and every day? So what we were fortunate to have some support to do is to develop a framework. And I very intentionally, once again, use the term framework, not model. You cannot go to Cincinnati. I just want to tell you right now, go to Cincinnati, visit, see what's going on, pick that thing up, and drop it down in Monterey County. I can tell you just from my drive here from San Francisco, it is very, very different. I love Cincinnati, but that sunshine was addictive. I mean, it is awesome. There is no model for how to do this work. There is no one-size-fits-all way to do this. And if you're looking for that, you're not going to find it. What there is, though, is a framework now that says there are certain things that you need to be thinking about. Sites all across the country have said, this is sort of like the headings of chapters in a book. And every community has to begin to figure out what is the content beneath each heading and each subheading. The key areas are shared community vision, evidence-based decision-making, collaborative action, and investment in sustainability. Shared community vision, extremely difficult, but sounds pretty simple, right? How could we actually get a group of community partners to agree on a vision that's not all about the Little Red Schoolhouse in education, but recognizes this cradle-to-career continuum, And most importantly, how could they begin to organize themselves, not into a governance structure, because we're not creating a 501c3. How could we get them to organize themselves into an accountability structure where collectively everybody shares accountability for results, even recognizing that there is differentiated responsibility each and every day? This accountability structure is critical. What are the roles and responsibilities of leadership? Yes, you do need a leadership table where those folks that actually have their finger on resources are able to make decisions in new and different ways. But equally important is a data table. Equally important is a kindergarten readiness table or an early grade reading table or a college completion table. There are all sorts of tables that need to be developed. And the question is, how do they all interrelate? You don't necessarily need to create them. As I said, there's a great early childhood group formed right here, right now. The question would be, what does that group need from key community leaders in order to expedite their progress? And conversely, what do those leaders need to know from the practitioners on the ground in order to make more informed decisions? That's what we call the value exchange. And within this shared community vision, it's not just visioning what we want to see happen down the line. It's understanding how all the different sectors and how all the different leaders that contribute to cradle to career outcomes connect to each other and interrelate in order to achieve our ultimate result. Next is evidence-based decision making. And this is getting agreement on that true north. And it's critical here, as I said before, to not let perfect be the enemy of good. We have found that when it comes to data in communities, people will argue over and over and over again about every single outcome. Everybody wants the perfect outcome. Usually people initially point to, we want an outcome for parent engagement. I would love to have that outcome. And if somebody in this community knows how to measure that consistently at scale across an entire community, please find me afterwards. In the short term, what we need is to identify a core set of indicators that this community believes are fundamentally critical, that act as those vital signs to say we simply have to improve these in order to know that we are making progress on improving the cradle to career continuum. And then connected to that is, how do we begin to build the data management systems that can actually connect programmatic services on the ground to the dials we want to move? We often say this is the least sexy aspect of this work. But as some of the data gurus in town said to us earlier today, they understand that this is fundamentally critical. Because until we actually get to the point where we are disciplined enough, where we are rigorous enough to actually be brave enough to look at the programmatic activities on the ground that we are implementing each and every day and be honest about whether or not they're moving the dial, we're going to keep spraying and praying. We have got to be disciplined enough to collect that programmatic data and be willing to connect it to our ultimate outcomes. Next is collaborative action, and this is all about capacity building. As I said, people in the education and social sector in general, they are afraid of data. They are afraid of data, and rightly so, because they've been beaten up by it for years. It is absolutely critical to recognize that folks that are working with kids on the ground are pouring their hearts out. I worked in the largest public high school in Washington, D.C. My wife worked there. She taught remedial kids in ninth grade that were reading at a third grade level. She worked 95-hour weeks. I barely even saw her. I don't know how she married me. I don't even think she really knew who I was. They're working their hearts out, right? They are every single day. What they long for, based on what we have heard from community partners all over the country, is true access to data that would help them do their jobs a little better, and then true access to the support services that can make sure that every aspect of a child is being addressed. That is what people really want. And collaborative action is all about building the capacity to ensure that data can be provided and that those connections can be made so people don't have to work 95-hour weeks. That's just not healthy. That's why they're burning out. So that people can actually begin to work real hours and know that there's a broad support system there to ensure that every child succeeds. And the last piece of this framework is investment in sustainability, and there's three key pieces here. One is mobilizing the broader community. Quite frankly, there's a lot of sausage making that goes into this early phase when you're identifying outcomes and establishing your vision. But once you begin to identify concretely what is moving the dial, we have seen community members respond in droves. They want to be a part of a winner. So in Cincinnati, we found that a certain type of tutoring, if it happened once a week with the same tutor for at least an hour and the teacher gave the tutor information on what the child really learned, we found that that type of tutoring, was able to catch kids who were far behind back up to their peers, if done consistently over time. The key was, how do we then make sure that if congregations want to volunteer, if businesses want to adopt a school, that they are able to do that type of tutoring? The community partners made sure that that infrastructure was in place, so as we began to mobilize community members around results, they were able to get in the classrooms and get the kids who needed that type of support, the support that they needed. So mobilizing the community around what works is fundamentally critical. Second is making sure that there's anchor staffing in place. You do, quite frankly, need somebody who wakes up thinking every day about only this. That's what I got to do for 6 years in Cincinnati. We call it the chief cat herder. The person who wakes up every day thinking about where is everybody, right? How do we keep people focused on that true north even when every incentive in the world is pushing them in different directions? Next, you need data analysts. You need people waking up thinking every day about how to help practitioners collect and manage the data they need and then analyze it and feed it back to them, not so it's in the newspaper, but so that they can use it to do what they're doing better every day. And the last piece is you've got to have facilitators that are working with practitioners who are already overloaded with things to do, who can begin to help them take that data and influence what they're doing on the ground. You've got to have some of that core staffing in place in order to drive this agenda. It doesn't have to be a huge staff. And frankly, it's better if you repurpose existing staff. I was repurposed from a foundation that simply said, he was doing this, we're now going to have him do this. That was powerful because it showed we're not trying to reinvent the wheel. We're trying to build on our existing assets. And then the last piece is mobilizing investors. A lot of people think that the hardest part about this work is actually getting practitioners to work together. At the expense of offending some investors in this room, I would say that getting them to work together is equally, if not more, difficult. And when I say investors, I mean private philanthropy and public officials. It is very difficult, and not because they don't want to in many cases, for them to begin to think about how they're going to get through legacy funding or how they're going to get around policy issues, to think about driving and aligning resources behind what works. But unless you have a partnership with all these key influencers organized, with data experts at a table, with advocacy experts at a table, with practitioners informing them about what works, we're going to continue to spray and pray. So the bottom line is this framework begins to provide a picture of what it looks like to do this work. But what we started to hear from communities was that they actually needed a better picture of how this work rolls out over time. And as you begin here in Monterey Bay, to think about taking on this work in Gusto, you have examples, I hear, in Santa Cruz. You have examples in other parts of the state that are doing this well. But for you specifically, right here in Monterey Bay, there are some key milestones along the way that help you get eventually to systems change. Very early on, it's primarily about the outcomes, how you organize yourself, and your staffing capability. You've got to figure all those things out right up front. And there's a group of leaders that we hear are coming together already to begin to think about how to mobilize the broader community to shape this vision and to select these outcomes. That's what we call the exploring benchmarks. Next would be emerging. In emerging, you're really building the data capacity. As you can tell, we really do believe that the step from collaboration to collective impact does hinge on the way we're going to use data. And quite frankly, what you find in most communities is the capacity to collect, manage, and utilize data is significantly weak. It is critical to figure that out. Next, you figure out how can we actually ensure that the data is not just sitting in some warehouse somewhere, where it often does, but it's actually being utilized by practitioners over time. How are they actually making sure that every single day this data is influencing how they serve children, and how do they make sure that they continue to improve even if they're already beginning to see success? Next would be systems change. And this is really where things... You can see powerful change in a community. How many folks have been part of a collaboration that died when a key leader left town? How many people have been a part of that? We are seeing all across the country that as people begin to think about how to build this civic infrastructure, it is actually building steam when a certain important leader leaves. And the reason it's doing that is because the work has been done, the groundwork has been laid, the trust has been built to make sure that there is not only agreement on that vision and the outcomes, but there is trust to say we have to protect what works. We cannot continue to reinvent the wheel. We have to begin to identify and build upon our successes. So systems change for us is that moment when individual organizations within a community stop making decisions only in their own interest, But equally as important, take into account the broader ecosystem and how their decisions impact everybody else that's trying to serve kids. That's what we want to see, right? And our hope at Strive Together is that by the end of 2015, we're going to have 5 proof point communities that have not only realized that they can sustain their work beyond leadership transitions and that they can begin to make individual organizational decisions within the context of the broader ecosystem, but they're going to start seeing the dials that they've selected continue to trend in the right direction over time. We need 5 communities by the end of 2015, 15 communities by the end of 2018 that can demonstrate the power of this work. The good news is that they're out there. And what I want to share with you is a few communities and a few examples of places that are actually beginning to see results. In that early stage of emerging, we have a couple examples in Salt Lake City and Anchorage that we think are fascinating. In both of these communities, interestingly enough, it's the United Way that is anchoring the partnership, but they have recognized that they are not the drivers of the action. They are servant leaders who are working to mobilize the community around results. And what's amazing about what they're doing is they're looking at data. They're looking at data and figuring out how they collectively can begin to integrate existing collective impact efforts towards a greater good. In Salt Lake City specifically, the United Way has completely changed and said, we're no longer even going to do an annual campaign. We're going to raise money around the outcomes that we know and collectively the partnership has embraced as critical for us to improve. The courage that it took for those leaders to make a move that significant should not be understated. And in all of these sites, the leadership has gone out on the line at some point and even made a mistake, but stuck with it. And when I say leadership, I mean leadership at all levels. It could be a practitioner that is working in early childhood centers that is leading the development of those child's minds that day to the president of a university who may have the responsibility for the economic development engine of that community. All of those leaders are sticking with it and getting results. In sustaining, we have Dallas and Albuquerque. And very concretely, Dallas did something that was just outstanding. They created something called Hope Charts. And this was a beautiful concept in its simplicity to try to break down this rather difficult idea of using data effectively to work with children, to work to improve the lives of children every day. They created a scatter plot, and on one side they put students that are passing, and on the bottom they put free and reduced lunch. And they looked at all the elementary schools within their region, and they put them on this plot. And essentially what they said was, we have a 50% achievement gap. This is unacceptable. We are seeing schools that are performing at 50 percentage points worse than their peers who are in the same demographic category. Where we have more affluent schools where we don't see this gap. So this was their call to action. And in every community, there is a clear call to action. And for them, it was around closing the achievement gap to make sure that this did not exist. But the very simple question that they asked is, how do we learn from what's happening up here and begin to make sure that we spread it to the schools here? And they've learned some incredible things along the way. Initially, when they created this scatter plot, they brought together only the principles that were defeating the odds. They brought together these principles that somehow were working in school environments that everybody else would say it's impossible to succeed. And they asked them the question, what are you doing to get results? And then afterwards, they brought together principals who were down here. How do you think that meeting went? It did not go well. What they learned was just like they had to build trust among community leadership, they also needed to build trust among the practitioners. So they actually brought together all the principals at all these various different places related to their performance, and they brought them all together, and they looked at the data in the schools that were getting results, and they actually visited the schools together where they were getting results, and they collectively began to identify those practices that seemed to be moving the dial. And they collectively have started to build action plans for how to take some of the activities that are happening up here and begin to implement them down here. My belief is that you're going to see in Dallas very soon some incredibly encouraging trends. Once again, not by starting new programs, but by identifying bright spots, working with those folks that are working their darndest to achieve the same results, to develop concrete action plans that get them, that can get them to a better place. Does that make sense? So the last site I'll highlight is Cincinnati. And what's interesting in Cincinnati is if you talk to people from there, they will tell you that they feel like we are stuck, right? On certain days, they'll say, God, I cannot believe we just had this new thing come in and nobody knew it was coming and all of a sudden it was here, or a policymaker made a decision that was way over here. But when you ask them about the long term, everybody has an understanding that we're trending in the right direction. I just want to make it very clear that there will not be a moment at which you feel like you have succeeded in this journey. Chances are, most days are going to make you feel like you have a lot more work to do. And quite frankly, my wife reminds me all the time that most of the gray hair I have occurred when I was working for 6 years as that cat herder. But the good news is that if we stick with it, right? If we begin to just believe that we can build that trust necessary to organize resources behind what works, we can start taking on big things. And in our community right now, you have the entire community getting rallied around a budget initiative that will end up putting an incredible amount of money compared to historical investments into early childhood education that nobody would have even considered before. But because we've identified what works, because there's a level of confidence that all the different partners are working together, we are able to begin to advocate more confidently than ever for resources, even if ideologically it would seem impossible. So what I would say is, as you think about moving from emerging to sustaining to systems change and eventually to proof point over time, you're going to get small wins up front, and down the line you're going to be setting the table to take on big things. But in the short term, be happy with the little wins. Don't look for the home run. So I'm going to close soon. One idea that I want to convey is that we really are moving from charity to investment. And this is a completely different mentality. I can't stress that enough. It actually seems foolish for me that we would talk about charitable giving when we know that every dollar we put into charitable giving, especially when it comes to education, is fundamentally critical to defining our future. It isn't charity. Quite frankly, it's investment. So if we think about, just like we did with collaboration and collective impact, what's the difference? Charity is driven by heart. Investment would be driven by the heart and the mind. We always need to have our heartstrings pulled. Not all of us are going to care about the same outcome. We're all going to be moved by different things, right? With 4 kids, 8 and 10, I'm pretty moved by this whole idea of early childhood and early grade reading, let me tell you. But I don't want to see the school where my kids go implementing programs and services that don't contribute to their growth or their peers' growth within that school. I want to see all the resources that we have being invested in those activities that I know is going to get the best return on investment. Next, when we talk about charity, we often talk about the number of people served. We were actually in one of the earlier meetings today, and we went around and had people introduce themselves, and it was wonderful. We came around to one person, and the person introduced themselves, and they said, "This is what I do." And they said, "I work with a collaborative, and our charge is to improve early grade reading by a certain percentage in a certain amount of time. That's what we do." It's not we serve 1,000 kids. It's not that we serve 2,000 kids, because what we really care about is what happened to those 2,000 kids. Did 500 of them get better results as a result of what we were doing? That is what we want to figure out. So for all of you right now who are asking, what's maybe one thing that I could do differently? If any of you serve on a board, if any of you are running an organization or a part of an organization, if tomorrow you had an opportunity to start asking the question, not about how many people are being served, but what is happening to those we serve, we will be in a much better place. That is one very small thing that every single member of a community can begin to take on. Next, we're not talking about the number of initiatives launched anymore. We're talking about the number of initiatives spread. Now, I even worry about the term scale. Usually when we talk about scale, we're talking about an individual program that we want to make bigger. And I would say as a part of this work, if we see something works, we absolutely need to make effective programs bigger. But more importantly, we need to take the practices they're implementing and spread them as far as we can to all the kids that need it. Now, I'm not saying that there's one practice that's going to work for every kid. Trust me. We've got to be disaggregating data. We've got to be understanding what works for different types of kids based on their backgrounds. We have to. But our goal should not be to start new stuff. It should be to identify those practices that work with kids based on where they come from and what they're up to, and make sure that those practices are spread as broadly as possible. And finally, we won't be talking anymore about the numbers of dollars raised. We will be talking about social return on investment. Imagine the day when we could actually say, we know that when it comes to early childhood, if we put this amount of resource behind a child who comes from this background and is facing these obstacles, we know that we can get them ready for kindergarten. Imagine if we can say that with confidence, the type of advocacy that we can do nationally. It shouldn't be about how much money we're putting into things. It should be about what's the return we're getting in the long run. So I will leave you with this image. We would say that the traditional educational mental model would be the school at the center with support services all around. And quite frankly, when I worked at the public high school as the peaceable schools coordinator, which they thought was perfect since I had just come out of the Peace Corps, I thought this was the right model. I thought this was exactly what we needed. I thought that my wife and her friends who were teachers in that building, they just needed to be able to draw upon different assets. I've come to change my opinion, and I've come to believe that we actually need to put the student at the center. We have the ability to understand what is the progression of a child developmentally, and what are all the support services they are receiving. We have the ability to do that. We don't do that. I can't be any more blunt about it. We have the ability to understand what each and every child needs. I had the privilege of doing one of those TED Talks. It was a little TEDx thing. And it occurred to me as we were prepping for it, when I go to the grocery store now, I swipe my shopper's card. Do you all have that out here in Monterey Bay? You know what I'm talking about? Every time I shop, I swipe my shopper's card. Amazingly now, over time, when I get my receipt, I also get about 5 or 6 coupons for things I actually want to buy. That freaks me out. That's crazy. But how is it that they are crunching numbers behind the scenes about what I want to buy and are targeting me to get me to purchase things that I want? And we can't be that disciplined about using data to figure out how to get the right services to kids at the right time. That's astonishing to me. Quite frankly, it's mind-blowing. We have to be willing as communities to come together, to bring everybody together, to begin to say we are going to be more disciplined than ever, to stop putting institutions at the center and to start putting the child. To start to say we are going to take the time, energy, and talent of our community and put it behind what really works for kids. We're not going to make assumptions anymore. We're going to figure this out. The truth of the matter is, I don't know how it's going to look here in Monterey Bay. I don't think anybody in here understands what it's going to look like in 4 or 5 years. And as Martin Luther King said, that's really what faith is all about. I would encourage all of you to go down this road, to begin to take the steps needed to figure out how to build this civic infrastructure. The good news is you have tons of assets in place. I met with about 15 people who are all leading what are now termed as collective impact initiatives already underway in your community. The key for you all might not be actually having to figure out how to start new collective impact efforts. The key for you all might be willing to say, we at this point have a lot going on. We at this point need to start thinking more disciplined about how we collect, how we manage, how we utilize data, so that every single day all of these different efforts are getting what they need to ensure the practitioners on the ground can do what they do better and the decision makers can make sure that they have the support that they need. Bottom line, I don't know what it's going to look like, but I'm pretty sure based on what I've heard just in the last 24 hours around Monterey Bay that you all can figure this out. And I can't wait to watch you all go on the journey, and I quite certainly want to be here to help support you. Thank you all very, very much.